morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. There will come a time when we will all be sitting next to one another in venues, athletic, religious, civic, artistic, to cheer, discuss, laugh, enjoy, even grieve. But right now, that's not possible in most instances. So instead, we look for options elsewhere. How we're entertained by musicians and other performing artists are taking on new and innovative forms, and while they may not be exactly what we'd like to experience and how with these shows, it's what's available right now, and it is still exposing us to the arts. Now, one organization that is finding new ways to bring its plays to audiences near and far is Northern Stage in White River Junction, and joining us now to talk about that is their producing artistic director, Carol Dunn. Carol, thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thanks, Carol. And listeners, feel free to call with your questions or let us know about anything you've enjoyed at Northern Stage. Our numbers are 244-1777, also 877-291-8255. That's 291-TALK. And you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, Carol, in a normal year, what would Northern Stage's schedule be like?
At this point in the year, we would be doing a huge holiday extravaganza that maybe 10,000 people would come to the theater. It's a little different this year.
Yeah. How have things changed this year?
Well, you know, I liked that you spoke about innovation, and I think the world has been, you know, it's maybe an overused word at this point, but pivoting left and right since the pandemic began. And for us at Northern Stage, we're just led by, once, you know, March 12th hit, we wanted to matter to the community. We wanted to be there for everybody. And so what we've done is a hybrid of virtual programming and one live play. Literally between last March and now, we've programmed online talks and community activism. The live play is Fine, I'm Fine, and actually just as of two days ago, we finished recording a radio play of It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, my. Well, change is part of your company's credo, changing lives one story at a time. So how do you think Northern Stage changes lives?
So that is a really great question. Many theaters put art into the world and sort of, you know, hope you come. We choose art that we think will matter to Vermont, New Hampshire, and will matter now. And we feel that we change lives by starting conversations that matter. For example, this summer we had 500 people sign up for a book club of white fragility with an actress from the company who facilitated serious anti-racist conversations. We change lives by going into schools, rural schools mostly, and we teach kids to do Shakespeare and use their voices in new ways. And even we try to change lives with something as, you know, well-known as something like It's a Wonderful Life, but we put it on the radio in order for people to maybe turn down the lights, be with family, and just listen and imagine together. And last but not least, we try to change lives by getting to know everybody who comes through the door and being kind and open to them in what we think is kind of a revolutionary way.
Well, tell us about that. How do you do that?
Well, we have in the company, yes is the first thing that we wish to say. So, for example, a tiny experience like somebody comes in, maybe in a wheelchair, and the seat isn't working out, but the show has already begun. We've had experiences where three or four staff members in the middle of the show will move the seat, make sure the patron is very comfortable. And, you know, by the end of the show, we've had people say, I feel differently about your company because you took me, you know, more seriously. You didn't treat me as though I were an issue. You treated me as though I were family. Mm. And so we've doubled our audiences in the past 7 years with that attitude. Because people don't have to spend their money on something like theater. You know, food, heat comes first. But if we can enrich people's lives, then our mission is being fulfilled.
Now, Carol, one more big change that has happened at Northern Stage since you arrived 7 years ago is the new performing space, right? So give us a little tour of the theater.
Well, it's my favorite place in the world. It's the Barrett Center for the Performing Arts, the Burn Theater. We raised $7.5 million. I think the tour that I can give you of our facility is it still smells like the inside of a new car. It's so beautiful. We didn't spend a ton of money. We finished the project on time and under budget. We didn't think a $25 million theater was going to be appropriate for this region. The seats are very comfortable. They are wide. So you walk in and it feels like a grand experience. You can come in from upstairs. You see a highly professional, beautiful space, but it only seats 240 people.
Wow.
So it keeps an intimacy. The leg room is ridiculous. Every seat is perfect because the height, the rake we call it, of the seating is such that there's no blocking of any view. And so it's a little crazy for our financial model. It's difficult for us to make ends meet with only 240 seats in Broadway quality or world-class theater, we like to say. But it's a joy. It's a total joy. And people love the new space, and I think that's added to our audiences growing also.
And what does this space allow you to do?
Anything. This is what's remarkable about it. We just did a one-person show. It's Fine, I'm Fine. It's what's called a modified thrust. So you can have a huge proscenium where you do the Little Mermaid, and the mermaid is flying just like a Broadway sort of box, you know, that the stage looks more like a box.
Mm-hmm.
But then we bring actors down into the house, up the aisles, through the audience. So there's much more of an immersive feel. The only thing we don't do well, I think, is theater in the round. We tried that once, and we found that, you know, those few people who were sitting on the stage were a little lonely. They wanted to be in the audience with everyone else. So that three-quarters immersion is what we do best.
Now, you just mentioned It's Fine, I'm Fine, which I believe was done before a live audience. Am I right about that?
It was, and it was quite a mixed experience. It was a positive experience. We were the first professional LORT theater, which is the highest level of regional theaters. It's a very complicated thing, but there is a group of about 70 theaters in the United States that we have the highest levels. We pay actors better. We have higher levels of really taking care of people. So we were the first to do a show indoors. We opened It's Fine, I'm Fine. We worked with Alice Peck Day Memorial Hospital, our underwriters. We were all COVID tested. We quarantined. We brought actors from New York, designers, et cetera. Fabulous. We could take 40 people a night. We were doing that. And then COVID got worse, and Vermont really closed the borders to New Hampshire, and we really are a Vermont-New Hampshire company.
Mm-hmm.
And we were down to 9 or 10 people a night for the last week and a half. You know, are we still filled with joy that we did it? Absolutely. Yeah. We learned so much so that as we emerge, you know, we know how to do this so safely. And it was completely safe, and that was an incredible experience. So then after that, we've gone purely online for the next couple of months.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about some of those shows that you're doing
Absolutely.
That for. Before
yeah.
we do, I want to ask you, so there's something you have there called the Tiny Necessary Theater.
Yes.
What is that?
Yes, that's the series that included It's Fine, I'm Fine.
Ah, okay.
Back in last, you know, April, we thought the arts are necessary. And just to loop back for 1 second, everybody who came to see It's Fine, I'm Fine, people were practically weeping. So mm-hmm. grateful. I think the one thing that the performing arts has probably earned through the pandemic is that people realize how necessary it is to be with human beings and to think and to feel, especially in such hard times. So TNT, we made it small projects. We chose It's Fine, I'm Fine by Stephanie Everett, which is streaming until the 29th. One woman play about resilience, a young woman who was a varsity soccer player. She had 4 career-ending head injuries and ended up leaving soccer, really losing her identity, but finding her identity as an artist. And it's a beautiful play. It's kind of necessary, right?
Right. Oh, I love it.
We have The Naked Librarian. Necessary, it's about love and how maybe one love that one has in one's life ripples through the generations of a family. You know, so that was really beautiful. Dutch Masters is no longer streaming, but we're going to bring it back. Really dealt with a young white man and a young black man in New York on a subway. You think the play is going to go one way, it goes another. Necessary. We have to talk about racism now and about how we as citizens of a very predominantly white region have got to start leading the conversation about anti-racism work. And so that's been the idea behind it, that it matters, that art matters. Mm-hmm. So, and then It's a Wonderful Life is not part of Tiny Necessary Theater. That's really our holiday, just joy and love, because we all need a lot of joy right now, we feel.
Oh, do we ever. We're going to talk more about the streaming. Oh, absolutely, Carol. And Carol, one of the things you're doing is streaming some of these plays. One is called The Naked Librarian, and I am so intrigued to find out more about this.
Good on you. Yeah, it's a pretty great title, isn't it?
It is.
So our playwright Maritza Smith wrote this story. She had a friend who sort of disappeared from the world to Mexico with his lover in the 70s. And this is a true story about someone who was on a beach in Mexico and decided to open a library on the beach and you know, drummed up some business by maybe losing some clothing. So, what's really fun about The Naked Librarian is it's now she's an older woman and she's looking back on her life. And this piece was filmed in Central Park. And the next segment of The Naked Librarian is the lover, right, the man, and he is now older and talking about his life. And then we get into a daughter, and then we get into a granddaughter. And it's all about how a great love affair ripples through generations and informs generations. And it's really about true love. And we just felt people needed an opportunity to laugh. And I think one thing to let you know that Northern Stage has done really differently is we filmed these things live. A lot of online content has been filmed just through Zoom. But because of our work with our Alice Peck Day Hospital, we were able to bring actors up here and film them safely on locations, house them. And it's given a lot of actors work during this crazy time. And the opportunity to work artistically with other people, you know, masks on, 6 feet apart. It's been a fascinating challenge, kind of like a Rubik's Cube for all of us.
Yeah, what so does it take?
Yeah, go ahead.
What does it take, Carol, to film a play? It's a different medium from what you're used to.
Oh, we are just joking among each other, you know, that we are learning how to make films now. For example, when we filmed Dutch Masters, we had the actors in our space at Northern Stage. We have to remain 6 feet apart. Everyone's tested twice a week. Masks on. Masks come off the actors when we start filming. But when we were filming it, I didn't know that I was supposed to look at the video monitor to see what it looks like. So I was, you know, helping to direct scenes thinking, that was fabulous. Having no idea that the camera saw something totally different. And, you know, one actor was dead blocking the whole thing, right?
Right.
So... But it's also been a lot of patience, a lot of, it's been a steep learning curve.
Sure.
You know, but we also learned that safety protocols really do work. So I feel like I know more about COVID than anyone.
And, I'm going to call you next time I need an expert on COVID, okay?
You really need to call Northern Stage. that's been a learning curve. The other thing that we've learned, though, is that when the masks come off and those actors who are 6 feet apart are acting together, it's better. You can get rhythm. You can get tempo. So when you see a play that we filmed live, it's much closer to the authentic experience. And that really matters. You know, you can't get tempo on Zoom. You can't. There's no rhythm. So if one actor is acting, there's always a little natural pause between the lines. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Have you watched much of this stuff, Rick? Have you watched much online content from any theaters or arts organizations?
I have not, and now I'm really excited to do so. I think you have another one on the harmful effects of tobacco streaming right now as well. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. And so the neat thing about that's an Anton Chekhov piece from 1880s. And it is about, it's just straight classic comedy, and it stars Gordon Klaff. And Gordon's an Emmy-winning actor from NYPD Blue. He is a beloved Northern Stage Company actor. And I wanted to pick something that's about 20 minutes long, and it is Gordon at his best. He is a henpecked husband. Perhaps not the most politically correct for me as a leader in women's rights in the theater to have chosen, but he's a henpecked husband, and his wife has forced him to do a women's club talk about the harmfulness of tobacco because she's sick of his smoking. So he has to stand up and talk about how cigarette smoking is bad, and he actually goes into lots of other topics, and that was filmed here at Broadway Stage. And Gordon is just, he's a brilliant actor. He knows how to work on film. So actually, one of us knew how to do filming, and it was Gordon for that project. So we put that in because during COVID, we read a lot of plays with audience members, and Anton Chekhov writes brilliant comedy. And you know what? We all need to laugh a lot more nowadays. It's a release. It's a release from the stress.
For the holidays, you mentioned this. You're doing a radio play, It's a Wonderful Life. Mm-hmm. How will that be presented?
So a couple of ways. You can stream it from the Northern Stage website, and a lot of people have been tuning into radio plays on their computers. They're turning on, you know, to you through their computers. And we're encouraging people, if you have a speaker, to set it up. You'll get better sound. You can also stream it in your car. That will be on our website for about 4 weeks, starting on the 8th of December. We have something really special also. VPR is going to be presenting it on December 12th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's really exciting to have everybody have the opportunity to listen to it. Now, It's a Wonderful Life. It's about an hour and a half. We have a wonderful cast, a diverse cast. We're trying to bring voices to this, you know, beloved classic that have not normally been included. And it also will have a lot of shout-outs to White River Junction history, Vermont history. We really tried to make it matter in a contemporary way to a contemporary audience. We have a local high school jazz combo providing some music. It's you know, I kind of think of it as the Our Town, which was written about our area. I think of it as the Our Town of the holiday season. So I hope people will be able to tune into that.
Sounds great. And hey, Carol, talking about a beloved classic, we have Rusty DeWeese on the phone right now.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, Rusty.
How exciting.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Yeah. Hey, I was just riding. I'm listening to your show. You've taken over there, sir, and it's a nice job. And you are a great representative to the Northern Stage. You have there's a positivity in your voice, ma'am, and your guys, just good luck with everything. I didn't even know about, you know, props to having the station have you on or whoever made it happen, because I didn't even know about that theater down there, and that's just fantastic. And good luck to you with these next upcoming shows, and keep it going. I really didn't know about that Chekhov piece either, about the harmful effects of tobacco. That's cool, huh?
Yeah. Oh, Rusty, thanks.
Oh, Rusty, that's so great. That means so much to us. Thank you.
I'll try to tune in and see Gordon Klaff on that. And maybe that's so have fun, and just really good piece, really positive, and you're not like blaming this or that. You're all going forward. So keep it up, and keep listening.
Thanks, Rusty.
Oh, thanks, Rusty.
He is so right, though, Carol. You have, from the moment you've been on with me, it's been very positive, very uplifting. And I would have to say, I cannot wait. I really want to leave in the middle of the show and go start streaming your shows. It really is great to hear what you're doing at Northern Stage.
Really. Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show.
Well, tell people how they can, you know, take part, how they can interact right now with Northern Stage.
Absolutely. We have our website, northernstage.org, and you will see everything about the streaming opportunities that we have. All kinds of ways to support us, too, I'll just say, because ticket sales are pretty lame right now because we can't charge a lot. We don't want to charge a lot. Look, I think the future of professional theater is free tickets. People should be able to experience the arts. And so God willing, after all of this, some change is going to take place to make theater accessible. The other thing to let you know is we create a lot of new theater here. We have a broad new play program called New Works Now, and we will have streaming in January, a new musical workshop, two new plays, one really interesting about what would happen if all of the trucking industry, if trucks were all automated. So interesting to sort of look at what happens to an entire industry and the people behind that. That's a play called Drive. And the other thing to let you know is we're probably, I'm pretty sure I'm not allowed to tell you this, but I'm going to. We're doing some mud season mysteries. I have the worst reputation for spilling the beans, but we're going to do some fun online mysteries in mud season when we'll all be going a little bit crazy, and that's going to be exciting, and maybe some outdoor theater in the summer. So it's all on our website, northernstage.org, and we have box office people. Well, one amazing person, Robin, who's sitting there talking to anyone who's calling right now throughout the pandemic. So
I love it.
That's the best way.
We're almost out of time, Carol, so I'll just kind of tell people Northern Stage also does a great amount of community outreach. They also have a robust education program, including with younger actors. So go to that website. It's northernstage.org. Is that what it is?
.org. Correct.
And learn about what they're streaming, what they're showing, and these opportunities. Carol Dunn is the producing artistic director of Northern Stage in White River Junction. Carol, thank you so much for making time to be with us this morning.
A real pleasure. Thank you, Rick. Take care.
Take care. CBS News is next. Then we'll be back with Ken Picard of 7 Days to talk about the WTF column. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. 7 Days does a great job with investigative reporting, and that can take many forms. It's not always trying to uncover corruption in government or embezzlement from a nonprofit. Sometimes it's answering a reader's question about something in their community, a structure, trend, sign, or person. 7 Days handles that in a column called WTF, and I'll only attempt this once. It means something like, what the fudge? Joining us now is 7 Days staff writer and WTF driving force, Ken Picard. Ken, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Ken about WTF, or if you've got some topic suggestions that you want them to investigate, please call now at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Ken, when did WTF launch and why?
Well, we launched this about 10 years ago, give or take. Before we get too deep into the specifics of the column, I want to say something a little bit about the origin of the name.
Yes.
The actual name of the column is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Oh, yes, it is.
Yep. And for any of your listeners who might be active or former military or international pilots, they'll probably recognize those words from the NATO phonetic alphabet. So, you know, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot. That's what pilots use because those words aren't easily misinterpreted on the radio, even if the signal breaks up. So one of the reasons that we chose that name is because if military pilots saw something when they were in the air, you know, obviously they're not permitted to swear over the airwaves, so they could say something like Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, and other pilots would know exactly what they're talking about. So that's a little bit about where the name came from. We sometimes get some angry letters from people, and for us, it's really more, look, we want to we all see or hear about things here in Vermont, and we drive by something and we want to know what's the story behind that. And so that's really how the name came about. And you know, over the years we've had people write in. They, you know, they're out in their car, they drive by a place day in, day out, and mm-hmm. then what's the story behind that? So that's where it comes from.
Do you hear from a lot of those military pilots you know, writing in or calling in with questions?
You know, we hear from everyone. I think what I find kind of interesting about the column is it's, you know, it's not just politics. It's not just, you know, what's going on with the highway department kind of stuff. It's mm-hmm. sometimes it's a science question or wildlife biology. Somebody will notice that, hey, there's so many more rabbits out there this year than there were last year.
Right. Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's like a legal or governmental question. People want to know, well, why is there a coal weir? You know, why does this town have a position, you know, somebody doing a job that is, you know, 200 years old and there's nothing for them to do? You know, sometimes it's just deciphering odd or unusual or bizarre human behavior. People see a sign out in front of somebody's house. They drive by every day and they want to know, well, what's the story about that? So, you know, for me, it's, I'm not the only one who writes it. Usually
right.
I am, but, you know, most of the time it's, you know, if you're human and you're curious about things that you see, it's kind of permission for us to be nosy and ask questions. And generally, you know, you come up with a question like that and sometimes it seems like it's really mundane. And the next thing you know, you're out there and, people are like, oh, yeah, I've been wondering that same thing.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you get a lot of questions submitted? And then how do you decide on which ones to chase down?
I wouldn't say I get a lot. And by now, we've answered a lot of the more obvious questions that we get. I think the best columns are the ones that are ones that people, that a lot of people may wonder about. But even more so, if it's something that has a really interesting or unusual answer to it, even if we can't necessarily find a definitive answer, but sometimes it's just chasing down the things that it might be. And so that's, you know, for me, that's always kind of an interesting process, is just, you know, digging into it. I don't know how much time you've ever spent up in St. Albans, but if you drive up that way and you're coming up I-89 from the south, you may notice there's this big golf ball shaped dome up on the hillside there,
right,
up on Bellevue Hill. And I always, you know, for the longest time I wondered about it. I just assumed it was you know, some kind of weather station or you know, some kind of radar for the airport or something like that. And so I decided to look into it one day, and it turned out that the story behind there used to be three of them up there, but they're called radomes, and they were built back in the late 40s, early 50s as part of the U.S. military's early advanced warning system to detect Soviet bombers coming over the North Pole. And that was really part of, you know, the Cold War defenses. There were, you know, hundreds of these domes that were scattered all across the United States. And from 1951 till, I think it was 1979, these domes were basically, you know, our defense system against the Soviets coming in and attacking continental U.S. And so anyway, so I, you know, researched a little bit and they heard it. Like it is often the case, sometimes you get a couple of things wrong. And so about a week or two later, I wound up getting a phone call from this 89-year-old man who lives up in Grand Isle. And it turns out that he was one of the base commanders up there. And he started telling me that, well, you know, there were three domes. They weren't five, like you wrote. And but then, you know, it was just fascinating to spend some time talking to a guy who had actually been there and been part of this. And he was a kid. He was, what, 21 years old when he was assigned to work there. And you think about it, here he was, you know, scrambling jets from, you know, from Burlington and, you know, other military bases if you saw a bogey. And so that was kind of his job. And so for me, it was just a, you know, it's a fascinating opportunity to sort of dig into a lot of the sort of odd and unusual stories that, you know, all around us all the time.
Did they ever catch any jets coming over the North Pole from Russia?
Well, no, they didn't. Short answer, no. But there was a time when he was there, and they picked up a bogey on their radar, and they couldn't identify what it was. And they had a telephone that would basically call the Pentagon, you know, their red phone, if you will. And and you know, one of his guys went to reach for it, and you know, he slapped the guy's hand. He's like, "Look, I think we just started there's a new radar up there. Just change your frequency." And their blip disappeared, and everything was fine. So
international incident averted just then.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you go investigating these questions?
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes if it's something as easy as, a sign that somebody has posted outside their house, you go ring the bell or leave a business card and wait and hope somebody calls you back. But sometimes it's a little bit more involved. The Vermont Historical Society or some of the local historical societies have been really helpful over the years. Librarians are an excellent source of information. They love to be helpful on these kind of projects, and I always welcome their assistance because they know how to find reliable sources on things. And sometimes it's just a matter of finding locals, people who know something about the local lore and can say, "Oh yeah, I remember this. I remember how that building got built." Or, there was a story I remember a number of years ago that somebody wrote in and wanted to know about this house that was built in the middle of the Winooski River near Montpelier, I believe. And so I couldn't find any records on it. So I went to the city hall. I went to the town clerk's office, and it turned out that the woman who was the clerk there, her dad knew the guy who had built the house. It turned out he was a widower back in the 1920s, and he lived there with his daughter, and it was just this crazy story. This house just built on this little tiny island, and it turned out that just talking to the folks in town, you know, it was like 2 degrees of separation there.
Yeah.
Was able to tell me the entire story.
I love it. Hey, let's take a call. We've got Bill calling from Moortown. Morning, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Hey, let me try to enlighten you. I just come in, turned the radio on. I like your station. I like what's going on this morning.
Yeah.
You know, in East Haven, East Mountain, there was a big radar base that was built there during the mid-50s.
Ken, are you aware of that one?
I believe so. I do remember hearing about another one in the area. I didn't go check that one out, I have to say.
Get up through there. You got to go up through the Victory. I was there. My dad did a lot of work up there, masonry work. And I was there when they was building it. And there was the Air Force manned that. And they must have had, their barracks was in East Haven.
Yeah.
But it was quite a operation up there. That was part of the Dew Line.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, okay.
All right.
And, Bill, what would have been the time frame of that?
What's that?
About when was that, Bill?
That was started about 1954, and they finished it probably in 56.
Yeah, so right in that Cold War time.
The Air Force manned it up to imagine, 64. I left. I went into service in 60, so I know I come home from Germany in 64, and they were still there then.
All right. Bill, well, thanks for that information, and thank you for your service. One of the questions you might explore at some point, Ken, is why East Haven is up in the Northeast Kingdom and West Haven is over on the opposite side of the state and pretty far south from it. So is it all Haven in between? I don't know. And in the interest of full disclosure, I must tell you that I was once the subject of that column in a piece not written by Ken. I'll let you search it if you're interested in my sordid past, which is not much different than my sordid present. Ken is discussing how he goes about digging into these questions and sharing some of his favorite columns, and you can join the conversation with Ken Picard of 7 Days by calling 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Ken, we've been talking about some of your favorites. One is Vermont is all about composting, but can Vermonters be composted?
Yeah, that's right. That one came up. I'm not quite sure who it was who suggested that one, but it seemed in keeping with Vermonters' somebody asked the question, can people actually be composted? And it sounds like kind of, Soylent Green-esque, but, there's now one state that currently allows it, state of Washington, and it turns out that there is a Vermont connection to it. The woman who came up with the idea, she founded a company called Recompose. It's a, it's a corporation, nonprofit company or public benefit corporation out in Washington. And basically what they do is they will compost to your loved ones in this sort of natural, organic way. The woman's name is Katrina Spade, and she's a New Hampshire native, but she studied here in Vermont. She went to the Esther Morrow Design and Build School in Waitsfield, and she came up with a way of basically breaking down the human body in about 30 days. And part of it is her environmental ethos. She wanted to basically find a way of, not necessarily taking up a lot of open real estate. Vermonters were real concerned about how her land gets used. And rather than putting bodies into a cemetery with lots of headstones, she thought, well, how about we find a way of returning people to the soil a little bit quicker. And so it was actually kind of fascinating that this is one of the ways that people, at least out in Washington, are doing it. As far as I know, nobody has proposed doing this in Vermont yet. There are some green burial type proposals, cemeteries that don't have headstones and bury the bodies a little bit shallower so that the body breaks down and whatnot. But, this was a kind of a fascinating question that also had a really interesting answer. So, that was kind of a fun one to dig into, if you will.
In each column, you float your own theories. How often are you right before you start investigating a piece?
most of the time, not. The idea is if you go in with an open mind, you try to come up with your own theory as to why this is the way it is or where something came from. And but it's like I said, the most interesting ones are the ones that have sort of the unexpected answer or no answer at all that you can nail down. But sometimes just floating a few ideas out there and somebody like, your caller Bill will reach out and say, hey, I know the answer to that question. And then they'll follow up with me and I'll have a nice conversation. And, if nothing else, it's a chance for me to get to know my neighbors here in Vermont. And, it's a fun process because I think so often we spend time, we focus on the things that are going wrong in our world or in our state. And this is sometimes an opportunity to celebrate our sort of quirky history,
right,
or just, sort of the richness of the human condition here. And it's, it can be very rewarding. Sometimes it may just be rewarding for me as a reporter to be able to dig into the history and learn things that I didn't know at the beginning of the week. So, I always enjoy the process, and it's always an opportunity to get out there and talk to Vermonters.
Well, I've got some favorites, and mine are usually about a structure or public art, and I really wish now I had researched this to make sure that at least one of these three were a column you wrote. But there's the bowling ball pyramid on Route 15. There were random acts of art in 40th and Allen, and then there's these baseball player cutouts. I think it's in South Burlington that go up, I think, every baseball season. Do you remember any of those?
Yeah. I don't think I did. It's funny. I didn't do any of the baseball ones. But, you know, it's funny. There is, you know, art's a big one because people will always, they'll put out these, you know, they'll ask these questions about some sign that they drive by all the time. And, you know, something, you know, some art in a field or something like that. And, for me, it's I don't remember what the story was behind the bowling balls. I think the baseball players was somebody who was I believe he was a scout. He may have been a scout, but
he was a fan of Mickey Mantle. And the bowling balls, they used to own a bowling alley. I remember that. And they decided that would be a really neat piece of art out front. So there was one, and we only have a few minutes, but there was one that kind of didn't get answered. Maybe it did, and it was the naming of Iranistan Road in Burlington.
Yeah. So this is one that I must have been asked this question two or three times, and I think when we started the column. But really, you know, this is one of those questions that, you know, the word Iranistan, you're not going to find it. It has no connection to Iran or Afghanistan. You can Google it, and it's going to come up in video games. And this one, I must have spent a week just chasing down theories on and was never really able to get a solid answer to it. But at the same time, it was one of those questions that just it led in so many different directions. It led to Vermont's U.S. Senator Warren Austin, who was a Republican who represented the state of Vermont from 1931 to 46. And he lived on Iranistan Road, and he was an ambassador to the U.N. And so people theorized, well, maybe he had a connection to the name. Maybe he named it because it was a street name that goes back to the 1930s. And then, you know, there were other theories about the guy who founded Kool-Aid is from a town in Iowa that is named Iranistan. And and then there was a connection to P.T. Barnum, who had a place in Connecticut. He built this big mansion, the Oriental Villa. He built it in 1848, and he named it Iranistan. And so was there some connection to Vermont? Well, it turns out that one of the guys who was friends with the Barnum family actually had a connection to Vermont or connection to Burlington. So it was just one of these things that you just could not, nobody can give me a definitive answer, but it was just fascinating to see, where did this name come from? And even the people in the city planning office, they have no idea where it came from. No local historians were able to sort of say, yes, this is how this street got its name. And, you know, some mysteries are just lost to time. But
I love it.
This one was fun to chase.
Yeah. Ken Picard, staff writer for 7 Days and major domo of the paper's WTF column. Ken, it's been great fun. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
CBS News is next, then we'll be back to talk wood heat on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. If you've been in Vermont for more than a few years, you've probably driven by dozens of piles and stacks of firewood in various stages of preparation for the winter season. Well, even though people have been heating with wood since just about the beginning of time, the last few decades have brought huge changes to the way we burn wood. And even though cutting down trees and setting them on fire may seem like the opposite of environmental progress, wood heating is actually key for the state of Vermont's climate goals. Here to talk with us about the finer points of heating with wood is Emma Hansen. She's the Wood Energy Coordinator for the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. Emma, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we're also joined by Adam Sherman. He's manager of the Biomass Energy Resource Center. Adam, thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. And listeners, you can join the discussion about your questions or experiences with wood heating. You can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Emma Hansen, let's start off with the big picture. How much of the state is actually using a wood stove or a pellet stove to heat their homes or businesses through the winter?
Yeah, about 40% of residences use wood as a heat source in their home. You know, but overall, if we look at big picture across the state, so commercial as well as home installations, we get about 21% of our thermal energy from wood heat. So, you know, just to break that down quickly, for often when we talk about energy, it easily, electricity and the words energy can get used interchangeably, but it's important to keep in mind that energy includes electric, thermal, and transportation, and since we're cold and rural place, those thermal and transportation pieces are pretty important. So 21% of just our thermal energy comes from wood.
And how about schools? Are we using it a lot in schools right now?
Yeah, it's actually very common to use wood heat in schools. That's a really great application of the technology. And it's roughly about two-thirds of Vermont students attend a school heated with wood.
Wow. So, Emma, we think of wood as the most basic heating fuel, but it's gotten amazingly high-tech, a lot of that innovation fairly recently. What brought us from kind of old-school logs into, in a fireplace to the modern-day automated pellet boilers?
Yeah, it's a pretty big jump when you think about it.
Yeah.
The fireplaces, I think that, you know, that's sort of a great place to start talking, because the fireplaces are really not heating appliances at all. They're really just decorative objects in your home, and they're very cozy.
They're romantic.
They're very warm when you're sitting right next to one, but they actually pull heat out of your house and send it up your chimney. So not a heating appliance. But then, you know, in the past 30 years or so, we've gotten really good at heating with wood. And, you know, wood stoves have gotten incredibly more efficient and clean burning. We've also developed much cleaner wood boilers. And then we've also developed technology with pellets, so we can heat with pellet stoves and automated pellet boilers. And both Adam and I can wax on the merits of any number of those for quite some time.
Good. That's what we want today, because we want people to really learn, like me, who's more of a newbie in this subject, to others who have been using wood heat, and this can be kind of their master's education. So we'll be covering a lot of ground with the two of you. Adam Sherman, the EPA has new 2020 emission standards for wood stoves. How much have wood stoves improved in the last 20 to 30 years in terms of air pollution?
Yeah, so air quality from wood heating devices is regulated at the federal level by the US EPA, and the last set of regs came about in the late 80s, and just in 2020, there's new, much more stringent standards that require that all equipment be certified to emit less than 2.0 grams per hour of particulate emissions, and so that's an order of magnitude lower than what typical equipment was putting out in the 80s and 90s. So we, you know, that reduction is anywhere between a tenfold and 15-fold reduction in the amount of particulates put out hourly or, you know, over the course of an entire heating season. So that really adds up. So there have been a lot of programs to incentivize these best-in-class new stoves and also to change out older systems that were, you know, more less efficient and more polluting. So kind of replacing old antiquated wood stoves with newer modern ones is a big part of improving air quality in Vermont.
And Adam, while you're not suggesting people should keep their old ones, but are they kind of grandfathered in when it comes to these standards? Are the standards for new ones that are being built, or do people need to replace the old style?
Great question. Everything that's already existing in use is grandfathered. It's only for newly purchased and installed systems that it's now, you know, you physically can't go into the local stove shop and buy and have installed a system that doesn't meet the new 2020 EPA standards. So it's only for new purchases.
But I would guess if somebody's driving a Prius and owns a 1980s wood stove, they'd want to upgrade and do right by the environment with one that meets the new standards.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's surprising how, folks have a love affair with their wood stoves. And, you know, if I bought a wood stove back in 88 and it was top of the line at the time, and I was really proud of how, its overall efficiency and emissions rating at the time. It's important to remember that while it's still probably plugging away and has a good 10, 20 more years of life in it, that the new equipment is just dramatically better. And at some point, thinking about replacing anything that was installed, or manufactured in the 80s or earlier should be a top priority for replacement in the coming years.
Emma Hansen, we just heard Adam use that word efficiency. What is it about the design or features of a stove that can make it make a piece of wood burning more or less efficient?
You know, there's a few pieces. We went through a phase, and it's sort of coming back now too, where using catalytic converters in stoves can help improve efficiency. There's different and better use of baffles, tighter construction, all sorts of different technical advances that really help to get a more complete combustion so that you're not sending fuel up and out of your stove. And there's a variety of different techniques that you use, but really the science has really gotten it dialed in as, you know, the EPA has set stricter and stricter standards to make these stoves more efficient and more cleaner burning.
Well, who wants to talk about what makes them more efficient? Get into that kind of technical side. This is now for the master's student who knows wood stoves. But, you know, what are some of the things that make these more efficient?
Adam, I'll gladly defer to you.
All right. Sounds like it's yours, Adam.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So combustion is really, controlling the amount of air being supplied to the combustion. Certainly dry fuel is a big piece. But in terms of the combustion chamber and the engineering itself, there's the three keys of combustion: the time, the temperature, and the turbulence. So the time is like the time that the gases stay in the combustion chambers. The temperature is how hot the fire is in terms of whether it's at 1400 degrees Fahrenheit or upward to 2000 degrees in the combustion. And then the turbulence of the airflow and the recombustion of the gases to get the complete combustion, but also get as much heat exchanged from the combustion chamber to be emitted before the thermal energy goes up and out the stack. So if you have a very high stack temperature, you're putting a lot of energy up the flue out of your house or your building. Mm-hmm. You're trying to harvest as much of that thermal energy off before it goes up the stack. And so a lower flue temperature before it goes up the chimney is part of that, you know, efficiency. So there's efficiency of the combustion, but then there's the efficiency of the heat exchange.
How do we get that heat to flow through a house? Or can we?
Well, lots of simple ways. Small, you know, I have a wood stove that I'm sitting next to right now. It's pumping out. I have a ceiling fan in my main living room that helps circulate. I've got a small passive fan on top of, on the surface that helps move some of the air around. That's great for wood stoves. You know, pellet stoves have blowers that kind of pump the air out. Using, you know, mechanical fans and blowers inside the stove itself. But for larger homes, you know, the availability of a centralized system, either a furnace or a boiler, can actually distribute through, you know, zoned and controlled and thermostatically controlled heat delivery. With a boiler, putting out hot water to baseboard or, you know, in-floor pipe top water.
Yep.
Or if you have a centrally ducted home with air vents that's tied to a furnace, there are pellet-fired furnaces that can do that as well. So there are whole home heating solutions that can run on automated pellet boilers or furnaces.
And let's talk to Rich, who's calling us from Starksboro. Good morning, Rich. What's your question?
Good morning. I've got a question. It's probably for Adam. It's got to do with, like, say, having a home-sized furnace or boiler that operates off of conventional wood chips that you might get from a large three-point hitch PTO-driven wood chipper, you know, not the pellets. Are any of those in production available to buy? And if not, do you think it's even feasible? And if you have time, I'd like you to follow up on the turbulence thing for a solid fuel stove or furnace. Is the turbulence inputted external air helpful for that, or what? A little bit more elaboration on the turbulence. Thank you.
All right, Rich, thanks for that call, and let's get an answer from several things that Rich wants to know about, Adam. You know, he wants to know, first of all, about wood chips from a chipper. Can you buy them, and are they even feasible to use? And then wants you to kind of elaborate more on the use of turbulence.
Sure, yeah. So with the wood chips, wood chips are a really common heating fuel in Vermont. And so all the schools and hospitals and college campuses, a lot of these bigger systems utilize wood chips. And they have fuel conveyance and storage that make the larger shape and size of the wood chips. It makes it feasible, so that it's just kind of oversized augers and motors to move the material from a fuel storage bin into a boiler system. And one of the cool innovations in the last 5-10 years have been specialty dried wood chips. And so now we're seeing smaller size boilers that are commercially available on the market, mostly imported from parts of Europe, especially Austria, that are available to essentially perform very similar to like a small-scale pellet boiler system, but can use a slightly less refined fuel in a drier wood chip. And they have very comparable performance in terms of efficiency and emissions. So those systems are like scaling down to the capacity of heat demand, say for like a small town library or town office. But they're now actually scaling right down to like a residential size system. And so there's a couple of folks who import these boilers from Europe. They're pretty sensitive to the moisture content of the chip. It needs to be down in the kind of 25 to 30% range for most of those. Green harvested fuel tends to be in kind of the 40 to 45%. But if you can effectively dry those, if you're producing your own, it sounds like you have a tractor with a PTO-driven chipper, as long as you can kind of chip and produce a fairly even-sized matchbook-shaped wood chip and get it to the target moisture content down under kind of 30, 35%, then it is technically feasible to do, maybe after the fact we can point you to some resources of some of these manufacturers of the Austrian boilers that can handle a dry wood chip.
Oh, excellent.
So that's on the wood chip piece. To dive a little bit deeper on the turbulence, there's kind of the primary air combustion, secondary and sometimes tertiary combustion of how air can be brought into either actively or passively into a combustion chamber. And as those gases are released off the fuel bed, at certain key points in the routing of those flue gases, you can be adding in secondary or even tertiary combustion air to create the turbulence and the further recombustion of those gases to get complete and efficient combustion. So there's different ways, like a wood stove does it more passively. Some of the newer designs have like channels through the roof of the stove to get that recombustion and supply of air, either in the front or the back of the stove or in through the top. And then like larger industrial boilers have, fans and injection points at different stages of the routing of the combustion gases as they're routed up through the heat exchange of the boiler tubes before going up and out the stack. So I hopefully that's a deeper dive into the turbulence question.
I think Rich is enjoying that answer from the warmth of his wood-heated home. We did get this from Tim. He emailed, is there a way to test for carbon, and how is it known if the new is better than the old? Emma, can you answer that one?
I guess I'm not quite sure what Tim is getting at with that question.
We're talking about the state of Vermont's carbon emission goals, and part of that is wood heating. We're also talking about, these new EPA standards. So how do we test for, the carbon output from wood stoves and know that the new are better than the old?
Okay, so you aren't referring to new carbon versus old carbon. So there's a few different ways I could answer this question, depending on how exactly I want to interpret it, I guess. But we don't necessarily measure carbon output from a stove, because the how much carbon is in a piece of wood is in a piece of wood, no matter what ends up happening to a piece of wood. So if a tree falls in the forest, regardless of whether or not someone is there to hear it fall down, it's going to release the exact same amount of carbon decaying on the forest floor as it would burned in a stove, old or new. And so the carbon sink in a piece of wood is what it is no matter what, and when that wood no longer exists, that carbon is released. Now, another way to think about carbon is what we refer to as geologic versus biologic. So that's sort of a way to think about old and new carbon when we are talking about, sort of the carbon neutrality or not of burning wood, because the carbon that's used in trees and is all above ground has been circulating in the atmosphere forever. And then the carbon that is used when we burn fossil fuels is being dug up from the ground where it was safely tucked away and then introduced into the atmosphere. So there's a few different ways to think about this question, and I get where he's coming from of wanting to think about certainly reducing the amount of carbon that we use. And if you're using a more efficient stove, then you'll be using less carbon to heat your home.
So if we know that trees are going to release carbon no matter what, if we use it to replace a fossil fuel, which will release carbon into the atmosphere, we're actually negating that carbon released by the fossil fuel by using wood to heat rather than just letting it emit the carbon laying on the the ground in a forest. Am I right? Am I following this?
Yeah, no, you are. Like, for example, so if you think about it as if we had never figured out coal or oil and we were at all just been using trees and, you know, the warmth of the sun for all of our energy needs this entire time, we wouldn't have a problem.
Right.
It's because we've introduced carbon that was already safely stored away into the atmosphere that we have a problem, because we've broken the balance of how much carbon is in the atmosphere. You know, trees emit carbon and then they sequester carbon, and they emit carbon and they sequester carbon in a cycle. But we've broken the cycle by introducing fossil fuels.
Gotcha. Adam, should a fire from the wood stove, should it be emitting a lot of smoke?
I'll come back to that, but I just also want to go to Tim's question. There's a potential that he was acting or talking about carbon monoxide, which when we're talking about combustion efficiency, there are measurements of carbon monoxide as an indicator of incomplete combustion. So I just want to make sure that as we delve into the discussion of the carbon dioxide discussion and kind of the macro level, you know, implications of that from climate change, that the nature of Tim's question might have been stemming from the kind of the technical and, you know, the turbulence and all the combustion conversation that we were having previously.
Gotcha.
So it is important to note that people do talk about carbon monoxide as an indicator of incomplete or partial combustion.
Getting really deep into the science of it now. We're going to be taking a break here, so I'm going to come back to the question I asked you about smoke from a wood stove. We are talking about heating with wood today. Our guests are Emma Hansen from the wood. She's a wood energy coordinator from the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. And Adam Sherman is manager of Biomass Energy Resource Center. You can join the conversation at 244-1777. You can call toll-free 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Growing up, I'd help my dad when he would install oil burners. It was his side hustle, and when I say help, I'd lend muscle to drag the old behemoths out of basements up rickety cellar stairs. I really wasn't familiar with wood heat until I moved to Vermont in 2003, and I still haven't lived in a home that uses it, so I'm dangerously unclear on the concept. Luckily, today we have two guests who can educate the newbie and can take old hands to the next level. I'm joined by Emma Hansen. She's the wood energy coordinator for the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, and Adam Sherman, manager of the Biomass Energy Resource Center. And listeners, if you'd like to ask them any questions, you can call us at 244-1777. Toll free, we're 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And Adam, as I right before the break had to throw a question at you, I want to ask you again, should there be a lot of smoke from my wood stove?
No. Modern equipment, burning dry, properly seasoned firewood should really not be producing large amounts of visible smoke. At the time of startup and as a fire dies out, there's a little bit more, and there's some incomplete combustion at that time, and there's can be some visible smoke at that time. But once you have started a fire up and if it's burning clean and efficiently, it should not be, you know, billowing plumes of visible smoke. You know, both pellet stoves and wood stoves can achieve clean combustion, and there should just be, you know, kind of more of a water vapor plume that can be visible, but generally speaking, not a dark or, you know, the opacity should not be, you know, too visible if it's being done properly. You know, I think there are certainly old equipment. So as you drive down the road in Vermont and you go by various homes, whether it be a wood stove in the house or one of these outdoor wood boilers, oftentimes you will see visible plumes of smoke coming off of them. That's probably an indication that it's older equipment, or they're, you know, burning, you know, really green or improperly dried fuel in older equipment. And that's not an example of kind of best-in-class wood heating.
Well, let's talk about specifics of firewood. Emma Hansen, what is the best kind of wood to heat with?
Yeah, I mean, it's dry. Full stop. And then from there, you can get more nuance. But more important than anything else is that you're burning properly dried firewood. And so for it, that means that your wood is at 20% moisture content or less. And you might not know exact. I have my stove going right now. I can't tell you if it was 19, 18, or 21. But you do want wood that has been properly dried and stored. And, you know, if you're burning wood that has a higher moisture content than that, you're creating a few problems for yourself. One is you're wasting money and time because wood won't ignite until it's reached a certain temperature and moisture content anyway. So if you put wood in there that's green and you've got water coming out of the end sizzling, I think we've all seen that on occasion when one wet one sneaks in there, then you're basically just wasting heat because instead of that heat going to heat your home, it's going to heat the water out of that piece of wood before it can actually ignite and start burning. So you're wasting fuel and you're also creating more smoke, and you're also creating creosote that can line your chimney, and burning with green wood can, for that reason, end up causing chimney fires, which we certainly want to avoid.
So what should people look out for when they're buying their first load of firewood?
Yeah, I mean, so start by asking your dealer good questions. Right, so when you buy wood, it kind of comes in four different categories, and really only two of them are super clear cut. So you can buy wood that is green, and that means wood that's been freshly cut, right? That is what it is. That's going to be about 40% moisture content, and that's the least expensive fuel to buy. So if you can think ahead and you have the space, the best thing you can do is buy green and then just dry it yourself. That's economical, and you can give yourself at a very minimum 6 months, preferably a full year to dry it, and then keep 2 years worth on hand. So you are always sort of one cycle ahead. The second type of wood you could buy is seasoned. And this is definitely a gray area where it's not quite dry, not quite green. Maybe the dealer split it 3 months ago. So if you buy something that's described as seasoned, expect to pay a little bit more than green, but also still expect to have to dry it some before it's ready to be burned. Then you can buy dry wood, which is wood that has been air dried and should be ready to burn at the time it's delivered. Now, when that arrives, it should be a nice dry product. So when you pick it up, it should be noticeably lighter than a piece of green wood if you have one around. If you knock it two pieces together, this should sound hollow. That's a good tell. Or you can use a moisture meter. So a moisture meter is a little device that you can use to stick the probes into the wood, and it'll give you a reading of what the moisture content is. So that's a little bit more sophisticated way to get an idea of the moisture content. And then there's kiln-dried wood. And kiln-dried wood has been heated in a kiln and is definitely dry, ready to go. And that's a very clean, nice product. Definitely the most expensive option, but it's always available because it's fired in a kiln. So when it's hard to find other dry wood, you can still find kiln-dried. But it's the most expensive option.
Gotcha. Adam Sherman, where does wood fit into the state's goals of reducing carbon emissions?
Yeah, so wood, when used, you know, from local well-managed forests to directly offset fossil fuels, is a strategy for reducing our long-term carbon emissions. Thermal energy is about a third of our total energy, as Emma mentioned at the kind of the beginning of the program. Mm-hmm. And so, we have a state target of achieving 35% of our total thermal energy through an increased use of wood heating in the state of Vermont. And so that's kind of an integrated component of the overall carbon strategy, but is kind of woven into the renewable goal of achieving 90% renewable energy in Vermont by the year 2050. That's been a goal on the docket for, I believe, about 4 or 5 years now.
Well, will we be able to cut down that much wood sustainably in Vermont for those heating needs, those thermal energy needs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the answer is yes. We have done some work with the state of Vermont, Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, to quantify the forest resource base in Vermont and how much of the acreage is actively managed and is the rate in which it's growing and the rate in which it's being harvested for all the other, you know, current products that the forest yields. And so that quantification, the study that was done in 2018 and released in 2019, concluded that there's about 1 million tons of wood above and beyond our current market demand that is low grade and is, you know, part of the managed resource base here in Vermont, that could be used for increasing our use of wood fuel. And so 1 million tons sounds like a huge number, and quite frankly, it is. But on an energy content basis, that's about enough wood energy to displace about 50 million gallons of heating oil annually. So that's a huge chunk of our fossil fuel use in Vermont. So using that resource of what we can sustain year in, year out, and help, you know, manage our forests and increase growth and yield over time and carbon stocks in our forest, can also then be used to directly displace fossil heating fuels like oil, propane, and natural gas as well.
Emma Hansen, one of the big advancements in stoves recently has been with wood pellets. How do these setups differ from the classic wood stove with logs in it?
That's a great question, Rick, because a pellet stove really looks and functions much like a wood stove in that it's sort of this attractive box that is a space heater in your living room and it's pleasant to enjoy. So in that sense, it's the same. That doesn't replace your whole central home heating. But in function, it can be pretty different and can be sort of life-changing for people that are used to a wood stove. Because I have a wood stove, so I can endearingly refer to it as our infant, that it needs attention pretty frequently, even though it's a very good one. Whereas a pellet stove is a bit more of a teenager. You can leave it alone for a whole day, and it's fine. You know, so a pellet stove, you can load in the morning with a load of pellets. You can sort of set the thermostat on it, and you can walk away, and you can leave it for a whole day. And so for people that go to work during the day and don't want their stove going out while they're gone, it's a great option. And it's much more affordable than getting a pellet boiler. So if you have, you know, sort of an existing central home heating system that's still on fossils, that's not at end of life, and you're not ready to rip that out to replace it with a pellet boiler, but you really want to make a switch to heating with a renewable fuel, a pellet stove is really a great option because it can run pretty hands-off. You can easily replace 70 to 95% of your home heating needs with a pellet stove for only, you know, $4,000, $3,000 to $5,000, depending on the unit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Adam, what about options that, you know, people like, you know, being able to set their thermostat from their smartphones, you know, in bed or in their car, not having to think about feeding that fire all the time. Is there a place for them in our wood-burning future?
Absolutely. So in Vermont, we've seen, in addition to pellet stoves as an appliance in your living room or a space that you want heating as a single, you know, heat emitter, the option to buy and have pellets delivered in bulk. So, I mean, there are now in Vermont a handful of bulk pellet trucks that are going around and pumping pellets out of the truck into a storage bin in people's homes and their basements. And so it's being delivered like propane or oil. A truck pulls up, hooks up a hose to a port on the outside of the house, and a bulk bin in the basement is being filled with a pneumatic or air blower system, floating pellets from the back of the truck into the storage bin in the home's basement, and then automatically, based on the thermostat control settings in the house, the call for heat sends a signal to the boiler to crank it up, and then pumping hot water to the radiators throughout the home based on the kind of the thermostat's call for heat. So there are you know, set it and forget it solutions where, you know, someone can be at work and, you know, pull up their smartphone and connect into their home's Nest thermostat, that they can change the settings and crank the temperature up before they drive home at the end of the day, so the house is warm and toasty. And they can also monitor the pellet boiler's performance directly from their smartphones. So the appliances that are available and the convenience of automated bulk pellet fuel delivery, where you're not schlepping, you know, a 40-pound sack of pellets to a stove, but it all happens automatically. Those solutions are out there, and they've been increasingly used by Vermonters for the last 10 years. There are really strong rebates that are available in the state of Vermont for those pellet boilers are available.
That's very exciting. Well, Adam, Emma told us a little bit about the system she has at home. How about you? What are you doing? What's your home heating setup?
I actually am sitting right next to my cordwood stove. That's a brand new EPA 2020 compliant wood stove. And you can probably actually hear it snapping and crackling in the background right now.
What does it take, I'll start with Emma, what does it take to convert from some other heating source to wood heat? If someone in their home says, boy, this sounds great, this is what I want, I want to be part of the solution and not the problem, but I've got an oil burner, I'm using natural gas, you know, what does it take to convert over to wood heat?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, honestly, it doesn't take as much as people think. Economically, it makes most sense to do it when you need to buy a new heating system anyway. You know, so if your boiler is coming to end of life or your furnace is coming to end of life, that's really the sweet spot, the right opportunity. If you're motivated to do it sooner, then good for you. Otherwise, when that system is at end of life, you know, you want to call up a few different advanced with heat installers. There, you can get a good list from Efficiency Vermont, or you can just contact me and I'll send you a list myself. And if you've got a boiler, so if what you have in your house is radiator, so you have hot water coming through your pipes, then what you have is a boiler. And most advanced wood heat systems are boilers, but furnaces work as well. So if you have forced hot air, so they can do a replacement of that system depending on, you know, the state of your radiators. Sometimes people don't think that, you know, when their boiler reaches at end of life, their radiators may have reached end of life also. So it's just something to keep in mind, regardless of whether you're sticking with fossils or switching to wood. And then when your oil tank or your propane tank comes out, what they'll replace it with is some sort of pellet storage bin, like Adam mentioned. And pellet storage bins can come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. So there's really a solution for every home setup. If you have room in your basement, it's quite likely that you'll end up with either a plywood bin or the sort of fabric sided bin where they'll store 2 to 4 tons of pellets at a time. Or if you don't have a basement or you don't have room in your basement, they can do an outdoor storage solution as well.
Now, Tim followed up with his earlier question to let us know, he made this point, wood is the only real carbon neutral heat source. Also got a note from someone else, they just brought this in to me, and asking what the spontaneous combustion temperature is of firewood. Is that something people should be worried about when storing firewood? Who would know that one?
Interesting.
I'm not worried about it. I'm going to let Adam answer, though.
Okay.
So wood can spontaneously combust, but there are absolutely no examples of it in the scientific literature in cordwood form, in chunk wood. So spontaneous combustion can happen in very, very, very large outdoor wood piles of wood chips. And it's actually the microbial metabolic energy that gets so hot as they're breaking down the carbon in the cellulose, hemicellulose, and lignins that can actually generate temperatures high enough to spontaneously combust. So it's more of an issue in like wood chip piles at large facilities like composting operations that have been known to have spontaneous combustion. But the amount of surface area and moisture content that's necessary to have that happen, it really only happens in large wood chip piles and not in stacked cordwood.
Gotcha. Emma, you know, no matter if we have an old or medium or new wood stove, maintenance is an important part, I think, to make sure that it remains efficient. So are there things we should know about maintaining properly our wood stoves?
Yeah, so the most important thing is to get your chimney swept every year. It's really good peace of mind just to have a professional clean it, inspect it, and make sure that everything is good to go for a safe burning season. You want to make sure that all the creosote that has accumulated from the previous burning season is scraped off and that there aren't any cracks or other issues in your chimney to be concerned about. Beyond that, you have your basic ash removal, but that's pretty standard. The most important thing that can get overlooked or skipped is the chimney sweep, and that should definitely be a priority for folks.
Adam, are there places where wood stoves aren't a good fit?
I'll say that there's a right solution for every application. So whether it's a large college campus heating with a campus district energy system fueled with a central, wood chip boiler, or, I used to live in a small town in a village, and I had a pellet stove, and, the power didn't go out very often. Now I live up on the hillside of Camel's Hump, up, 8 miles up a dirt road, dead ends, and the power outage, and 12 acres of managed woodlot on my land, a cordwood stove was the solution. So, I think that wood heating, there's a right choice for every application, and depending on the homeowner's objectives of whether they want supplemental heating, whole home heating, and whether they want to do it with a self-supply of their own fuel, or to buy an engineered delivered fuel in a little nugget like a wood pellet. There are just options that are available. There's no right or wrong. Solutions for every application. Yeah.
And Emma Hansen, if this hour wasn't enough for people to learn about wood heating, where do they go to really dig deeper and learn about what makes sense for them?
Great question. And certainly, I know I could talk about wood heating for a lot longer than this hour. But there's a few places to go. You can go to our website, the Forest Parks and Rec website. If you go to fpr.vermont.gov/woodenergy, you can find some links to some good information as well as a list of all the current available rebates on all the various types of wood heating appliances in Vermont. I'd also plug feelgoodheat.org. It's to learn specifically about more automated wood heating. So if you're interested in that whole home central pellet boiler system, that's a great place to go. And then the Efficiency Vermont site has great information on the rebates that are available through them, as well as pellet boilers, pellet stoves, and wood stoves.
All right. Emma Hansen, Adam Sherman, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Our pleasure. Thanks so much for having us, Rick.
And that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Peter Cormier. And I'm Rick Singeri, and I will meet you back here tomorrow.